J.T. He said nothing. Come on, tell me. He ignored me. Price returned with Otis. Wait for me over there, J.T. told me quietly, nodding toward the car. I did as he said. I climbed into the back seat, which faced away from J.T. and the others. Still, I was close enough to hear J.T. tell Otis to put his hands behind his back. Then I heard a punch, fist hitting cheekbone, and after about 10 seconds, another one. Then, slowly, two more punches. I looked behind me through the back window and saw Otis bent over holding his face. J.T. was slowly walking back toward the car, shaking his fist. He got in, and then Price did too. "You can't let them steal," J.T. told me. "I like your take on what happened." "You're right. They both fucked up. Since we don't really know if Billy didn't pay, I can't beat him. But like you said, we do know that Otis stole something because he didn't deny it, so I had to punish him. I let him off easy, though. I told him he only had to work free for a week." I could hear Otis moaning in pain like a sick cow. I asked quietly if he was okay. Neither J.T. nor Price answered. As we drove past Billy and Otis, I was the only one who looked over. Otis still had his head down, and he turned away as we passed. Billy just watched us drive by, completely expressionless. We spent the next several hours driving around the South Side, covering the great swath of territory controlled not just by JT's faction of the Black Kings, but by other gangs within the BK Nation. As JT rose within the BK's citywide hierarchy, part of his broader duty was to monitor several BK factions besides his own to make sure that sales proceeded smoothly and that neighboring gangs cooperated with one another. This meant that he now oversaw, directly or indirectly, several hundred members of the Black Kings. There was a constant reshuffling and realignment of gang factions. This typically had less to do with dramatic events like a gang war and more to do with basic economics. When one local gang withered, it was usually because it was unable to supply enough crack to meet the demand, or because the gang leader set his street dealers' wages too low to attract motivated workers. In such cases, a gang's leadership might transfer its distribution rights to a rival gang, a sort of merger in which the original gang got a small cut of the profit and a lower rank in the merged hierarchy. If running a drug gang wasn't quite business as usual, it was nevertheless very much a business. Today was the day that JT needed to visit all the 4- and 6-man sales teams occupying the street corners, parks, alleyways, and abandoned buildings where the Black Kings sold crack. He did this once a week. Because these visits were perhaps JT's most important work, it was pretty obvious that I wasn't going to have much input. But as JT drove to his first stop, he told me that I could at least tag along. By now a second car had joined us, occupied by 4 junior gang members. They were JT's security detail, driving ahead to each location and paging him to say it was safe from rival gangs. As I watched JT question his sales teams, one after the next, I began to realize that he truly was an accomplished manager. All his members knew the drill. As soon as JT reached a site, the sales team's director would approach him alone and instruct his troops to stop all sales activity. One member, taking all the cash and drugs, left the area entirely so that the police couldn't link JT directly to the drug sales. It was unclear to me whether this was JT's idea or standard practice in gangland, but when it came to avoiding the police, JT was meticulous. In order to keep himself clear, he never carried a gun, drugs, or large amounts of cash. Even though he occasionally alluded to cops he knew personally, men who'd grown up with him in the neighborhood, he was always sketchy as to whether he held any real influence among the police. Whatever the case, he didn't seem all that concerned about getting arrested. In his view, the police could come after him whenever they wanted, but it was in their best interest to let familiar faces run the drug businesses. "They just want to control shit," he told me, "and that's why they really only come after us maybe once in a while." His street dealers, however, were constantly getting arrested. From a legal standpoint, this was mostly a nuisance. From a business standpoint, however, it posed a disastrous disruption of JT's revenue flow. If a dealer went to prison, JT sometimes sent money to his family, but he was also worried that the dealer might decide to give testimony to the police in exchange for a reduced sentence. JT was more generous when it came to dealers killed in the line of duty. He nearly always paid their families a generous cash settlement. As he met now with each sales director, JT would begin by grilling him with a standard set of questions. You're losing any of your regulars, in other words, customers. Anybody complaining about the quality of the crack? You heard of people leaving you for others, customers buying crack from other dealers. Anybody watching you, the police or tenant leaders? Any new hustlers been hanging around? Homeless people or street vendors? You seen any niggers come around? Enemy gangs? After answering these questions, the director had to report on the sales activity over the past week, a summary of the week's receipts, any drugs that had been lost or stolen, the names of any gang members who'd been causing trouble. JT was most concerned with the weekly drug revenues, not just because his own salary derived from these revenues, but because of the tribute tax he had to send each month to his superiors. JT had told me earlier that his bosses occasionally changed their tax rate, even doubling it for no good reason, at least no good reason that JT was ever told about. When this happened, JT had to dip into his own pocket. A few months before, he'd had to contribute $5,000 to help build up the gang's arsenal of weapons, and he wasn't at all happy about it. These pressures, combined with his constant fear that his junior members were planning a coup d'etat, made JT paranoid about being ripped off. He had told me of several such coups in other neighborhoods, so he practically interrogated his sales directors, asking the same questions in a variety of ways or otherwise trying to trip them up. "So you sold 50 bags, okay, that's fine," JT might start. "No, I said we sold 25, the director would answer. "No, you said 50, I could have sworn you said 50. Everyone else heard 50, right?" No, I said 25. Invariably, JT and the young man directing his sales team, these directors were usually in their late teens or early 20s, would go back and forth like this for several minutes, often over a trivial detail, until JT felt confident that he was getting the truth. On this day, as the cold afternoon stretched into the night, I watched several of these young men sweat under JT's questioning. Surely they all knew by now what to expect of him. But even a hint of suspicion could earn them a violation. JT was quick to physically punish them or suspend their privileges, the right to carry a gun, for instance, or the right to earn money. JT also asked his directors about any behavior in the past week that might have attracted the attention of the police, a dispute between a customer and a dealer, perhaps, or any gunfire. If one of his members had been suspended from high school or had drawn complaints from a tenant leader, he would have to submit to even tougher questioning from JT. For the directors, the worst part of this interrogation was that JT maintained his own independent sources. He kept a roster of informants in every neighborhood where the Black Kings operated. He had begun this practice when he first became responsible for monitoring neighborhoods that he didn't know as well as his own. While he may have been familiar with the streets and stores in these neighborhoods, he didn't know every pastor, tenant leader, police officer, and hustler as he did in his own. Most of his informants were homeless people, squatters, or other hard-up adults. They came cheap. JT paid most of them just $10 or $15 a day, and these ghetto nomads could easily hang out in drug areas and spy on JT's gang members without raising suspicion. JT generally dispatched his senior officers to debrief these informants, but sometimes he met with them personally. Although they couldn't tell him if his own members were stealing from him, they were valuable for reporting problems like street fights or customer complaints. As we drove through the neighborhood past the blighted storefronts on 47th Street, JT told me that one of his sales groups was selling diluted product. The BK's crack-selling chain began with JT's senior officers buying large quantities of powder cocaine from a distributor in the outlying suburbs or a neighborhood at the city's edge. The officers usually cooked up the cocaine into crack themselves, using a vacant apartment, or paying a tenant perhaps $100 a month to use her kitchen. Then the officers would deliver the prepackaged allocations to the sales directors. Sometimes, however, the street crews were allowed to cook up the crack themselves. In such a case, JT explained, they might surreptitiously use an additive to stretch their cocaine allotment into more crack. They could turn each 100-pack of $10 bags into a 125-pack, which meant earning an extra $250. This money obviously wouldn't be susceptible to collection by JT, since he could account only for 100-packs. I was surprised that JT would give anyone a chance to rip him off like this, but he now had so many crews under management with such overwhelming volume that he occasionally farmed out the production. It was a relatively simple process. You mixed together powder cocaine with baking soda and water, then boiled off the water until all that remained were the crystallized nuggets of crack. Subcontracting the production also provided JT a hedge of sorts. Even if the police raided one of the apartments where the crack was being processed, he wouldn't lose his entire supply of cocaine. The sale of diluted crack troubled JT for reasons beyond the obvious fact that his members were stealing from him. Such entrepreneurial energy could be infectious. If other factions of the gang thought up schemes to increase their revenues, not only would JT lose taxable receipts, but his sales directors might feel empowered to try to knock him off his throne. He was also concerned about the physical dangers of diluted crack cocaine. Not long ago, a teenager in Robert Taylor had nearly died of an overdose, and rumor had it that one of JT's dealers had sold him crack that had been processed with a dangerous additive. As a result, the building president got the police to post a 24-hour patrol for 2 weeks, which shut down drug sales. JT's superiors nearly demoted him because of this incident, out of concern that he couldn't control his members. JT's other worry about altered crack was a simple matter of competitive practice. If word got out that the Black Kings were selling an inferior product, they would lose customers to other gangs. This was what troubled him most, JT told me, as we drove to meet with Michael, a 20-year-old gang member who had recently been promoted to run a 6-man sales team. One of JT's informants had told him that Michael's crew was selling diluted product. The informant was, in fact, a crack addict. JT had him buy the crack and turn it over to JT, who could tell from its color and brittle texture that the crack had indeed been stretched. JT asked me what I would do if I were the gang boss and had to deal with Michael. "Kick him out," I said. JT explained that this decision couldn't be so straightforward. "Most guys wouldn't even think of these ways to make money," he said. "Here's a guy who's looking to make an extra buck. I have hundreds of people working for me, but only a few who think like that. You don't want to lose people like that." What he needed to do, JT told me, was quash Michael's tactic, but not the spirit that lay at its root. When we reached Michael, JT told his officers and security detail to leave him alone with Michael. He asked me to stay. We went into the alleyway behind a fast food restaurant. "See this?" JT said, holding up a tiny Ziploc bag to Michael's face. "What is it?" "It's mine," Michael said. I had no idea how he could tell that the crack was his, and I wondered if he said so simply as a reflex. Michael had a stoic look about him, as if he were expecting to be punished. The rest of his crew watched from perhaps 10 yards away. "Yeah, that's right, and it's half what it should be," JT said.
"You want us to fill it up with more than that?"
"Don't play with me, nigger. I know you've been putting some shit in the product. I have the shit with me right here. How are you going to deny it?" Michael was silent. "I'm going to tell you what we're going to do," JT said. "I'm not going to put you on the spot. You're going to finish selling this, and next week you're not earning shit. Your take goes to all the other guys, and you know what? You're going to tell them, too. You're going to tell them why it's no good to make this weaker. You know why, right?" Michael, his head down, nodded. "Okay, then, you're going to tell them it's not right because we lose customers and then we don't have no work. And you're going to tell them that it was your idea. that you fucked up, and that as a way of dealing with it, you want them to have the money you would have made. Michael was now visibly upset, his face in a sort of angry mope. Finally, he looked up, groaned, shook his head, glanced away, kicked a few stones on the ground. It seemed as if he wanted to challenge JT, but he had obviously been caught, so he said nothing. After a while, JT called over the other members of Michael's group and finished obtaining his weekly report. It had been dark for a few hours now. My stint as gang leader for a day, albeit in a very limited capacity, was finally over. It was both more banal and more dramatic than I could have envisioned. I was exhausted. My head was spinning with details, settled and unsettled. I never did manage to decide how much the Black Kings should pay Pastor Wilkins for the use of his church. I had accompanied JT on site visits to roughly 20 Black Kings sales teams. Two sales directors had been taken off to a secluded area and given mouth shots for their transgressions. Another one, who had failed to make his weekly payment to JT, was levied a 10% fine and a 50% deduction of his next week's pay. But JT used the carrot as well as the stick. The workers in one group who had done particularly well were allowed to carry guns over the weekend. JT usually didn't let his members walk around armed unless there was a war going on. He also required that members buy guns directly from the gang. And he gave a $250 bonus to the members of another group that had several weeks of above-average sales. There seemed to be no end to the problems that JT encountered during this weekly reconnaissance. Problems he'd have to fix before they spun out of control. There were several incidents of customers fighting in public with a BK member who sold them drugs. In each case, the customer complained that the bag of crack was too small or that the product was not of suitable quality. A store owner reported to JT that several gang members demanded he give them his monthly protection payment. This couldn't have been a legitimate request, since JT allowed only his senior officers to pick up extortion receipts. A pastor called the police on one of JT's members who used the church parking lot to receive oral sex in lieu of a cash payment from a local drug user. And two gang members had been suspended from school for fighting, one of them for having a gun in his locker. The next day I would wake up free of the hundreds of obligations and judgments I'd been witness to, but JT wouldn't. He'd still bear all the burdens of running a successful underground economy. Enforcing contracts, motivating his members to risk their lives for low wages, dealing with capricious bosses. I was no less critical of what he did for a living. I also wanted to know more about his professed benevolence and how his gang acted on behalf of Robert Taylor's tenants, and I still knew very little about JT's bosses. But all that would take some time. My next set of answers about life in Robert Taylor came from the second most powerful force in my orbit, the woman known to one and all as Miss Bailey. Chapter 5. Miss Bailey's Neighborhood. I ran into Miss Bailey pretty regularly. Sometimes she accompanied JT as he made his rounds of the building. Sometimes I'd see her with a police officer or a CHA official. She always said hello and politely introduced me to whomever she was with, but I didn't really know what she did or how she did it. Although she was present at the backroom gang negotiation I witnessed at the Boys and Girls Club, she hadn't gotten very involved, so I was curious to learn more about her. Specifically, I wanted to know why residents spoke of her with a mixture of reverence and fear, much as they spoke of JT. "Oh, you don't want to mess with Miss Bailey," they'd say. "Or, yeah, Miss Bailey can tell you a lot about what's happening, but make sure you have $5 with you." Even JT, who agreed that I should spend some time with Miss Bailey, vaguely hinted that I ought to be careful around her. Part of my motivation to observe Miss Bailey came from my advisors at the University of Chicago. Gene Komaroff, an accomplished ethnographer, said that I was spending too much time with men. Since two-thirds of the community were women raising children, she suggested that I try to better understand how women managed households, secured services from the CHA, and otherwise helped families get by. Bill Wilson told me that poverty scholars knew little about the role women played in community affairs, and he encouraged me to spend time with household leaders like Ms. May, but also tenant leaders like Ms. Bailey. Wilson and Komaroff both advised me to exercise the same sort of caution with Ms. Bailey as I would with other powerful people, never taking what they told me at face value. Ms. Bailey was of average height and stout. Because of arthritis in her knees, she walked slowly, but always looking straight ahead with great focus, like Washington crossing the Delaware. She had a tattoo on her right arm that read, Mojo, the nickname Ms. May told me of a son who'd passed away. Ms. Bailey had pudgy fingers, and when she shook your hand, the tightest grip I've ever felt. Her title was Building President of the Local Advisory Council, LAC. This was an elected position that paid a part-time wage of a few $100 a month. The official duties of a building president included lobbying the CHA for better building maintenance, obtaining funds for tenant activities, and so on. Elections were held every 4 years, and incumbents were rarely deposed. Some LAC presidents were much more powerful than others, and from what I'd heard, Ms. Bailey was on the upper end of the power scale. She'd actually fought for the creation of the LAC many years ago, and she kept her fighting spirit. I'd heard stories about Ms. Bailey getting medical clinics to give free checkups to the children in her building and local stores to donate food. I witnessed this fighting spirit firsthand when I visited her small, decrepit office one day. I wanted to explain why I'd been hanging around her building and also explain my research. I began by discussing the prevailing academic wisdom about urban poverty and the factors that contributed to it. "You planning on talking with white people in your study?" she snapped, waving her hand at me as if she'd heard my spiel 100 times already. I was confused. This is a study of the Robert Taylor Homes, and I suppose that most of the people I'll be talking to are black, unless there are whites who live here that I'm not aware of. If I gave you only one piece of bread to eat each day and asked why you're starving, what would you say? I was thrown off by this seeming non sequitur. I thought for a minute. I guess I would say I'm starving because I'm not eating enough, I answered. You got a lot to learn, Mr. Professor, she said. Again, if I gave you one piece of bread to eat each day and asked why you're starving, what would you say? I was getting even more confused. I took a chance. Because you're not feeding me? Yes, very good. I felt relieved. I hoped no more tests were coming my way, but Miss Bailey kept going. Let's say I took away your house key and you had to sleep outside, she said. A man from the city comes over and counts you as homeless. What would you say? This one seemed even harder. I'd say you're wrong. I have a place to stay. So, no, I'm not homeless. I thought I had nailed this one. But she looked exasperated at my answer. Wow. Have you ever had to do anything for yourself? She said. I was at least smart enough to know that she wasn't literally asking me to reply. If I took your house key away, she barked. What does that make you? She leaned across the desk. I could feel her breath on my face. Well, I guess you robbed me, so I'm not homeless. I'm a victim. Okay, we're getting somewhere. Now let's say I tell the police to stop coming to your block and only go where I live, and then I write that you live in a crime-infested neighborhood, that there's more crime on your block than mine. What would you say? Well, I guess I'd say that it's not really fair because you have all the police. So, Mr. Professor, we're really getting moving now. Ms. Bailey threw up her hands in mock celebration. Okay, so let's go back to the original question. You want to understand how black folks live in the projects. Why are we poor? Why we have so much crime? Why we can't feed our families? Why our kids can't get work when they grow up? So will you be studying white people? Yes, I said. I understood, finally, that she also wanted me to focus on the people outside Robert Taylor who determine how the tenants lived day to day. But don't make us the victim, she said. We'll take responsibility for what we can control. It's just that not everything is in our hands. Our subsequent meetings were much the same. I would walk in to discuss an issue. the 60% dropout rate, for instance, among the project's high school kids. Research today says that if kids can get through high school, they have a 25% greater likelihood of escaping poverty, I said, as if giving a lecture. So early education, keeping them in school, is the key. Also, Ms. Bailey interrupted, if your family is starving and I tell you that I'll give you a chance to make some money, what are you going to do? Make the money. I have to help my family. But what about school? She said. I guess it will have to wait. Until what? Until my family gets enough to eat. But you should stay in school, right? She said, sarcasm rising in her voice. That's what will help you leave poverty. She paused. Then she smiled triumphantly and made no effort to hide her patronizing tone. So, you said you wanted to talk with me about high school dropouts? It took a while, but I eventually realized there was no point in trying to act even remotely authoritative around Ms. Bailey. There was part of me that felt like the expert researcher, but only a very small part. Once I learned that there was no way around Ms. Bailey's Socratic browbeating, I decided to give in and just let her teach me. I usually dropped by her office during the hours she reserved for open visitation from tenants. Otherwise, it would be hard to track her down. When a tenant came by, Ms. Bailey would ask me to step out. Our longest conversations, therefore, rarely lasted beyond 15 minutes. Ms. Bailey remained formal with me, as if she were keeping her guard up. She never shared details about specific tenants. Instead, she spoke in generalities about families who live around here. After a few months of this, I told JT that I was frustrated by my interactions with Ms. Bailey. I couldn't tell if she trusted me. JT enjoyed seeing me struggle. He had warned me that getting to know her wouldn't be easy, and perhaps wasn't even worth trying. It took a while before I let you talk with my boys, he said. What makes you think she'll just walk you around and show you everybody? Things don't go so fast around here. He had a point. If Miss Bailey needed time to feel comfortable with me, then I would just have to wait. As the Chicago winter began to settle in, Miss Bailey asked me to help her with a clothing drive. Tenants and squatters in her building needed winter coats, she said, as well as blankets and portable heaters. She wanted me to collect donations with her from several stores that had agreed to contribute. A friend of mine let me borrow his car, a battered yellow and brown station wagon. When I went to collect Miss Bailey at her building, she was carrying a large plastic bag. She grunted as she bent over to pick it up, and again as she set it down on the floor of the car. With labored breaths, she directed me to our first stop, a liquor store a few blocks from her building. She instructed me to drive around the back. She told me she didn't want the manager to see me, but she didn't explain why. I parked in the alley as Ms. Bailey went inside. 5 minutes later, a few employees came out the back door and began loading the station wagon with cases of beer and bottles of liquor. Nothing expressly for winter, I noted, although a stiff bourbon could certainly help take the sting off the Chicago cold. Miss Bailey climbed into the car. This donation, she told me, was made with the understanding that she would direct her tenants to visit this liquor store exclusively when they needed booze. We drove a few miles to a grocery store on Stony Island Avenue. We went in the back way and met with a man who appeared to be the manager. "Hey, sweetheart," Miss Bailey said. She introduced me to Mr. Baldwin, a large, pear-shaped black man with a round face and a wide grin. He had a clipboard in his hand, marking off the sides of beef hanging from a ceiling rack. Mr. Baldwin gave Miss Bailey a hug.
"I got what you want, babe," he said. "All in the back. I got 'em ready for you yesterday."
He pointed us toward a younger man who led us over to a few big garbage bags filled with puffy black jackets. At first glance, they looked exactly like the jacket the young man was wearing, which had the name of the grocery store prominently displayed on the sleeves and chest. Were they the same jackets? I wondered if Ms. Bailey's tenants would wear clothing with a grocery store's name on it. As I hauled the bags to the car, Ms. Bailey shouted at me, "And bring 3 cases of beer in here, Sudhir." I did as I was told. Even I, middle-class naïf that I was, could sense a horse trade. Back in the car, Miss Bailey anticipated my question. "I know you're wondering what we're doing at the food store," she said. "Take a look at the jackets." I reached into the back seat and grabbed one. It smelled distinctly of bleach, as if it had been disinfected. The store's patch had been either removed or covered up with another, even larger patch. It read, "Robert Taylor Pride." Miss Bailey smiled. "Those jackets are warmer than what most families can buy in the stores. These workers are sitting in a meat locker all day, so you know they have to stay warm. The manager donates about 20 to me each Christmas." "And the patches?" I asked. "The guy who makes the jackets for him does it for free, for us." "And the beer?" Miss Bailey just smiled and told me where to drive next. We hit several more stores that day. At Sears, Miss Bailey exchanged pleasantries with the manager, and they asked about each other's families. Then he handed over a few boxes of children's coats. Miss Bailey directed me to put the rest of the beer in his car. At a dollar store, Miss Bailey traded some of the liquor for a bundle of blankets. At a hardware store, Miss Bailey gave the manager the heavy plastic bag she'd brought along, and he gave her 3 portable heaters. "Don't ask what's in the bag," she told me as I carried the heaters back to the car. "When I know you better, I'll tell you." Only once did Miss Bailey receive a donation that was actually a donation, that is, something for free. At one grocery store, she got some canned food without having to exchange any beer or liquor. By the time we finished, we were on the far southern edge of the city. We hit traffic on the drive back to Robert Taylor, which gave me the opportunity to pepper Miss Bailey with questions. "When did you start doing this?" I asked. Miss Bailey told me that she had grown up in public housing herself. Back then, charities, churches, city agencies, and individual volunteers all helped out in the projects. "But the volunteers don't come around anymore," she said wistfully. "Have you seen any of those nice white people since you've been around?" "I didn't think so. Nobody gives us money. Nobody runs programs. Not a lot of people are doing the free food thing anymore. Even the churches really don't do what they did in the past." "But I don't understand why the people we saw today want to give you things. I mean, how did you get to know them?" "Well, first of all, most of them grew up in Robert Taylor, or they have family in the projects. Lots of middle-class people don't like to talk about it, but they came from the projects. It's easy to forget where you came from, but I try and remind these people that they were once like us, and a few times a year, they do the right thing." "So why give them beer and liquor?" I asked. "If it's a donation, it should be for free, no?" "Well, things ain't always that simple," Miss Bailey said. She brought up the incident I'd seen some months back when the woman named Boo Boo wanted to kill the Middle Eastern shopkeeper who slept with her teenage daughter. "That's what a lot of women have to do around here to get some free food," she said. "I don't want to see it come to that, so if I have to give away a few bottles of gin, that's fine with me." Back at her office, Miss Bailey organized the winter gear and prepared the large baskets filled with canned food and meat. Word spread quickly, and families from her building soon began to drop by. Some were shy, others excited. But everyone seemed happy, and I watched as children smiled when they tried on a new coat or a warm sweater. I noticed that some people received food but no clothing, others got a jacket but no food, and some people just stood around until Miss Bailey told them, "We don't have anything for you today." She said this even though the food baskets and clothing were in plain view, so I didn't know why she was withholding the gifts from them. Did she play favorites with some families? One day Clarice, the prostitute, walked into Miss Bailey's office. There were several women already in front of her. Miss Bailey's assistant, Katrina, was writing their names and noting exactly what each of them received.
"You got something for me today?"
Clarice asked, a lilt in her voice. Then her eyes landed on me briefly, but I didn't seem to register. She smelled like liquor. Her blouse was undone so that one of her breasts was nearly popping out. Despite the cold weather, Clarice was wearing a black miniskirt and sliding around perilously on high heels. Her face looked vacant, and her mouth was frothy. I had never seen her in this condition before. She had told me herself that she didn't do drugs. "You're messed up," Katrina said, peering over her thick glasses. You need to shower. Miss Bailey was in the next room, speaking with a tenant. Miss Bailey, look who's here, Katrina called out. Miss Bailey, you need to tell her to get out of the office. Katrina turned back to Clarice and shot her a disapproving look. Miss Bailey came out and told Katrina to calm down. Then she motioned for Clarice to come inside. As she closed the door, she rolled her eyes at me and sighed. I couldn't make out the whole conversation. It was unclear, in fact, if Clarice was talking at all, but some of Miss Bailey's proclamations were plainly audible. Get yourself clean, or you ain't getting nothing. Don't embarrass yourself, coming in here high on that shit. You call yourself a mother, you ain't no mother. You could be one if you stop smoking that junk. The door opened, and Clarice stumbled out, tears in her eyes. She dropped her purse, and then, as she stopped to pick it up, tripped and fell, ramming into the pile of donation baskets. As she tried getting up, Clarice vomited, some of it landing on the baskets. Katrina and I jumped over to help her. Both of us slipped on the vomit. A strong wind blew in from outside, and the smell filled the room. Clarice resisted our help, but she couldn't manage to get up by herself. Her pretty face had turned pale and pasty. "Grab her and get her out of here!" Katrina yelled. She had to say this two more times before I realized that she was talking to me. "Sudhir, grab her and take her home now!" I tried being delicate with Clarice. She was falling out of her clothes, and I didn't know quite how to touch her. She began throwing up again, and this time it landed on my arm. "Sudhir!" Katrina yelled. Clarice was on all fours by now. She was drooling and heaving, but nothing came out. This time I wrapped my arms around her stomach and yanked her up. I figured I'd better get her out of the office, even if I had to drag her.
"That bitch don't want me to feed my babies," Clarice moaned. "I need food to feed my babies."
She started looking around frantically for her purse, I realized. "Clarice, just a few more feet," I said. "I'll get your bag. Don't worry, but let's get out of the office."
"My bag," she wailed. "My bag! I need my bag!"
She started kicking and flailing, trying to make her way back inside the office. With one last effort, I heaved her upright, causing us both to stumble and slam against the gallery's chain-link fencing. She sank back to the floor. I hoped I hadn't hurt her, but I couldn't tell. As I turned to retrieve her purse, I saw Miss Bailey standing in the doorway. She held the purse in her hands.
"Is this what she wants?"
Miss Bailey asked.
"Is it?"
I nodded.
"Look inside. You want to help this lady? Then look and see why she wants her bag."
I shook my head, staring at the floor.
"Look!"
Miss Bailey snapped at me. She strode over and held the bag up to my face. I saw a few condoms, some lipsticks, pictures of her daughters, and a few bags of either heroin or cocaine.
"Have to have that fix, don't you, baby?"
Miss Bailey asked Clarice, sneering. We all stood there for what felt like an hour, but was probably only a few seconds. Katrina tried to interrupt, but Miss Bailey waved her off.
"Go ahead, Sue dear. Take her home,"
Miss Bailey said. She bent over to stare down at Clarice.
"If I see your babies coming over here and telling me they ain't eaten no food in 3 days, I'm taking them away. You hear?"
Miss Bailey turned and left. Katrina, with a disinterested look, handed me some paper towels. I bent down to wipe the vomit and tears from Clarice's face. She didn't resist this time when I helped her up. I walked Clarice upstairs to her apartment and led her to the couch. The apartment was dark, and I figured it would be best to let her sleep. In the back room, her two daughters were sitting on a queen-size bed. They looked to be about 2 and 4 years old and were watching the TV intently. I closed the door to their room and put a glass of water on the table next to Clarice. The scene was a study in contrasts. The apartment was neat and cozy, with wall hangings and framed pictures throughout, some of Jesus Christ and some of family members. It smelled as if it had just been cleaned, and then there was Clarice on the couch, breathing heavily, eyelids drooping, a total mess. When I had first met her on the gallery outside JT's apartment, Clarice had set herself apart from other prostitutes, the hypes and rock stars who sold sex for drugs. Plainly she had lied to me about not using drugs. I guess she wanted to make a decent impression. At this moment, I wasn't too concerned about her lies. She needed help, after all. But it was pretty clear that I had to be careful about blindly accepting what people told me. I sat on a recliner next to the couch. "I'm afraid to leave you here alone," I said. In the dim light, I couldn't really make out her facial expression. But she was breathing heavily, as if she'd just gone through battle. "Let me call an ambulance."
"I'm okay. I just need it to wear off."
"What about the kids? Have they eaten?"
"Miss Bailey wouldn't give us nothing,"
she whimpered, a stage past crying.
"Why she treat me like that? Why she treat me like that?"
I felt a sudden urge to make sure her kids were fed. I went into the bedroom, asked them to grab their jackets, and walked them over to a local sandwich shop. I bought them cheeseburgers, chips, and soda, and on the way home, we stopped at a small grocery store. I only had $15 with me, but I told the owner, a Middle Eastern man, that the family hadn't eaten in a while. He shook his head as if he'd heard this story a million times and instructed me to get what I needed and just take it with me. When I told Clarice's girls that we were going to fill up a shopping cart, they looked like I'd just given them free passes to Disney World. While they grabbed candy, I tried to sneak in a few cans of spaghetti, alas, one of the most nutritious items on the shelves, and some milk, cereal, and frozen dinners. When we got back, Clarice was asleep. I put the food away, broke out a few ringdings for the kids, and put them in front of the TV again. They fixed on the cartoon images as if they'd never been gone. Since Clarice was still sleeping, I left. 2 days later, I returned to the building, walking through the crowded lobby, nodding at the people I knew. I felt someone grab my arm and pull me into a corner. It was Miss Bailey.
"You're sweet, you're young, you're good-looking, and these women will take advantage of you," she said. "Be careful when you help them."
"Her kids hadn't eaten," I said. "What could I do?"
"Her kids ate at my place that morning," Miss Bailey said.
She tightened her grip on my arm and moved in even closer.
"I make sure they eat. No children go hungry in my building, no sir."
She tightened her grip even further, and it hurt.
"These women need to do the right thing if they have a baby. You remember that if you have a child someday."
"I will."
"Mm-hmm. We'll see about that. For now, be careful when you help the women. They'll take advantage of you, and you won't know what hit you, and I can't be there to protect you."
I wasn't sure exactly what Miss Bailey meant. I nodded anyway, mostly so Miss Bailey would loosen her grip. When she finally let go, I walked up to JT's apartment to wait for him. It was the second time I'd been warned that I couldn't be protected. First JT, and now Miss Bailey. I decided not to tell anyone, including JT, about the conversation I'd just had with Miss Bailey. In fact, the conversation had put me so out of sorts that by the time I got upstairs, I told Miss May I had some schoolwork to do and had to get going. She fixed me a plate of food for the bus ride home. A few weeks later, Miss Bailey invited me to the building's monthly meeting. It was open to all tenants and posed one of the few opportunities for people to publicly voice their problems. There were about 150 tenant families in Ms. Bailey's building. That included perhaps 600 people living there legally and another 400 living off the books. These were either boarders who paid rent to the leaseholders or husbands and boyfriends who kept their names off the leases so the women qualified for welfare. There were likely another few hundred squatters or people living temporarily with friends, but they were unlikely to attend a tenant meeting. Miss Bailey didn't seem all that enthusiastic about these meetings, but she let me know that she well understood their symbolic value. "They need to see that something is going on," she said, "even if nothing is going on." The meeting was held in Miss Bailey's office on a Saturday afternoon in December. Although it wasn't very cold outside, the radiator was at full blast and the windows were closed. Miss Bailey entered the steaming room and calmly walked past the few dozen people assembled on folding chairs, parking herself up front. She always sat down in the same awkward way, Because she was so heavy-set and because she had arthritis in her legs, she usually had to grab someone or something to help ease herself into a chair. I was surprised at the small turnout. The attendees were mostly women and mostly in their mid-50s like Ms. Bailey. There were, however, a few younger women with children and a few men as well. Ms. Bailey deliberately arranged a sheaf of papers in front of her. She motioned for a young woman to open up the window, but it wouldn't budge.
"Okay, this meeting is in session," Ms. Bailey said.
A well-dressed man toward the back of the room immediately jumped up.
"I thought you said you'd talk with those boys," he said. "They're still hanging out there, making all that damn noise. I can't get no sleep."
I assumed he was talking about the parties the Black Kings threw inside and outside the building.
"Did you make a note of that, Millie?"
Ms. Bailey asked an old woman to her left. She was the official LAC recording secretary. Millie nodded while scribbling away.
"Okay," Ms. Bailey said. "Go on, young man."
"Go on? I've been going on. I'm tired of going on. Each time I come here, I go on. I'm tired of it. Can you do something?"
"You got that, Millie?"
Ms. Bailey asked, looking over the rims of her glasses.
"Mm-hmm," Millie answered. "He's tired of it. He's been going on, and he wants you to do something."
"You can probably leave out the tired part," Ms. Bailey said in a serious tone.
"Yes, okay," Millie said, scratching away in her notes.
"Will there be anything else, young man?"
Ms. Bailey asked. He didn't say anything.
"Okay, then. I'm figuring you don't want to talk about the fact that you're living here illegally. Is that right? Now, who's next? Nobody? Okay, then. We have some serious business to discuss. Before I take questions, let me tell you that Pride will be here on Tuesday registering all of you to vote. Please make sure to show up. It's very important we have a good turnout for them."
Pride was the organization I'd come across earlier, made up of ex-gang members and devoted to gang truces and voter registration. Ms. Bailey had already told me that she worked closely with them.
"What are we voting for?" asked a young woman in the front row. "We're not actually voting, sweetheart. You need to register first. If you're already registered, you don't need to come. But I want every apartment in this building registered."
"Ain't you even a little bit concerned that we're just helping JT and the rest of them?" an older woman asked. "I mean, they're the only ones who seem to be getting something out of this."
"You want these boys to turn themselves around?" Ms. Bailey answered. "Then you got to take them seriously when they try to do right. It's better than them shooting each other."
"The voting hasn't done a damn thing for us," someone cried out. "So why are you so accepting of what they're doing?" A chorus of oohs followed the question.
Ms. Bailey shushed the crowd.
"Excuse me, Ms. Cartwright," she said. "If you're suggesting that I may be benefiting in any way by the voting stuff going on, you can just come out and say it."
"I'm not saying you may be benefiting," Miss Cartwright said. "I'm saying you are benefiting. You get that new TV on your own, Miss Bailey?"
This produced some more oohs and a round of outright giggling.
"Let me remind you," Ms. Bailey yelled, trying to reestablish order, "that we ain't had no harassment, no shooting, no killing for 6 months. And that's because these young men are getting right. So you can help them or you can just sit and moan. And about my TV, who was the one that give you $50 for your new fridge? And you, Ms. Elder, how exactly did you get that new mattress?"
No one answered. "That's what I thought. You all can keep up the bitchin', or you can realize that every one of us is benefiting from me helping these young men."
The rest of the meeting was similarly animated and followed the same pattern. Tenants accused Ms. Bailey of going easy on JT's gang and personally benefiting from her alliance with them. She replied that her job was to help the tenants, period, and if that meant finding creative solutions to a multitude of problems, then she needed to be allowed such flexibility. To nearly every resident who complained, Ms. Bailey could cite an instance of giving money to that person for rent, for a utility bill, or to buy food or furniture. She plainly knew how to play the influence game. I'd been to her apartment a few times, and although she never let me stay for long, it was a testament to her skills. There were photos of her with political officials, several new refrigerators from the CHA, and cases of donated food and liquor. One bedroom was practically overrun with stacks of small appliances that she would give to tenants in her favor. At one point during the meeting, Ms. Bailey mentioned the donations that she regularly procured from the gang to be applied to various tenants' causes. J.T. had repeatedly told me that he had to keep Miss Bailey happy, having his junior members carry out her orders, for instance, and paying her each month for the right to sell drugs in the lobby. But this was the first time I ever heard Miss Bailey admit to this largesse. In fact, she discussed it with a measure of pride, highlighting her ability to put the gang's ill-gotten gains to good use. Although none of the tenants said so, I also knew from J.T. that some of them received payoffs from the gang in exchange for their silence or for allowing the gang to stash drugs, cash, or weapons in their apartments. For a poor family, it was hard to turn down the gang's money.
"Why are we even talking about J.T.?" asked an older man. "Why don't we just go to the police? Can you tell me what you get from taking their help or their money?"
"You all want this place clean," Miss Bailey said. "You want this place safe. You want this and that, and you want it right away. Well, the CHA ain't doing nothing, so I have to find ways to take care of it."
"But we can't walk around safely," the man said. "My car got the windows shot out last year."
"Right," Miss Bailey countered. "That was last year, and sometimes that happens. But you see this place getting cleaned up. You see people getting rides to the store. Who do you think is doing that? Before you go yelling at JT and the rest of them, you better understand that they're family, too, and they're helping, which is more than I can say for you."
That a tenant leader, one who was respected by politicians, shop owners, the police, and others, would praise a crack gang and work so closely with its leader, made me realize just how desperate people could become in the projects. But I was learning that Miss Bailey's compromising position also arose out of her own personal ambitions. In order to retain her authority, she had to collaborate with the other power groups, in this case, the gangs, who helped shape the status quo. This resulted in the bizarre spectacle of Miss Bailey's publicly defending the very people who were shooting and causing trouble for her tenant families. Even though it was obvious that the tenant leaders had few good choices, I still wasn't convinced that they needed to operate in such murky ethical waters. Nevertheless, I found myself wondering how much Miss Bailey's actions were actually a response to hardships that limited her options, and how much arose from her own desire to have power. As the meeting broke up, people approached Miss Bailey for one-on-one conversations. They all had their grievances: no hot water or a broken sink, a child getting in trouble, prostitutes taking clients into the stairwell, crack addicts partying the whole night. Afterward, Miss Bailey motioned me into her office. Katrina was looking over some notes she'd taken at the meeting. Miss Bailey asked her to get together with Millie, the LAC secretary, to prepare a list of tenant concerns to pass along to the CHA. Miss Bailey opened a small refrigerator and took out sodas for all of us. Grabbing a small blue rag, she wiped her sweaty forehead.
"Did that live up to your expectations?" she asked me with a wink.
"Well, I thought you were just going to make a few announcements," I said, laughing. "What do you do with everything you heard? I mean, a lot of it was directed at you. They were saying some pretty harsh things."
"We tell the CHA that things ain't working in the building, and we try to get them to fix it. That's it."
"And you tell them about residents accusing you of taking gang money?"
"We tell the CHA that things ain't working in the building, and we try to get them to fix it."
She smiled cunningly and looked over to Katrina, who returned the dutiful glance of an ever-loyal junior officer.
"Sue, dear, you have to remember something," Miss Bailey continued. "In the projects, it's more important that you take care of the problem first. Then you worry about how you took care of the problem." I opened my mouth to object, but she stopped me. "If no one dies, then all the complaining don't mean nothing, because I'm doing my job. If all I got to worry about is a few people wondering where the money's coming from, then around here, that's a good day. No one dies, no one gets hurt. I'm doing my job." "That's an awful way to live," I blurted out.
"Now you're starting to understand," she said in a tone somewhere between pedantic and patronizing. "Maybe you're even starting to learn." Someone knocked on the door, and Miss Bailey got up to answer it. Katrina leaned in toward me.
"Watch how she helps people," she whispered. "She says it don't matter, but she's amazing. Have you seen how she gets apartments fixed around here?"
I told her that I hadn't.
"Have you seen how she helps women around here?"
Katrina pushed her glasses up the bridge of her nose and kept her voice low. I felt as if we were in high school and I was sneaking a conversation with the teacher's pet. "Well, Miss Bailey gives away food to the mothers, right?" I whispered back. Katrina shook her head and inhaled deeply, looking disappointed in me. "That's not what I'm talking about. You watch what she does when she helps women. Pay attention to that." Her voice was insistent, but she offered no more details. "She is the most amazing person I know." As I spent more time with Ms. Bailey over the coming months, I found that most tenants were less suspicious of me than they'd been in the past. Sometimes, when a tenant came into Ms. Bailey's office to talk about a problem, the tenant would say, "It's okay. I don't mind if Sudhir listens." Like JT, Ms. Bailey seemed to enjoy the fact that I was interested in her. Perhaps she, too, thought I was going to be her personal biographer. I could see why she might make this assumption. I took every opportunity to express my fascination for her life, which seemed more fascinating the more I hung around. One cold winter morning, I sat in Ms. Bailey's office with Katrina. It was a slow day and only a few tenants visited. Ms. Bailey asked if I would go out and get her some coffee, and Katrina came with me. We bundled up and trudged through the 8 inches of fresh snow. The wind was nearly strong enough to blow you over. It was too cold for even a conversation. Katrina and I just concentrated on stepping in the footprints of people who'd made a first pass in the snow. Katrina wondered aloud what kind of god would make the earth so cold. As we slogged our way back to the building, coffee and donuts in hand, a young woman hurried over to us as best she could. "Katrina, you gotta come quick," she said. "Miss Bailey ran upstairs to Tanisha's apartment. She said you have to call Officer Reggie." Katrina shoved the coffee at me and ran off as fast as possible under the circumstances. Since tenants had a tough time getting the police to respond, Ms. Bailey summoned Officer Reggie, the cop who'd grown up in Robert Taylor, when the situation warranted. "Where's Tanisha live?" I yelled. The young woman who'd summoned Katrina shouted back over her shoulder, "1204! Approaching the building, I encountered a couple of JT's gang members. They wore brown work boots and thick down jackets with the Oakland Raiders' distinctive silver and black insignia. To me it seemed too cold for business, but I could see a steady stream of cars coming down the alley to buy drugs. White and black addicts jumped out of their cars and ran into the lobby to buy crack. As I walked inside, one of JT's men shouted to me, "They're up on the 12th! Elevator's broken!" The stairwells were brutally cold. I had to stop a few times to catch my breath. I came across quite a few other people, all of them upset by the broken elevators. "Merry fucking Christmas," one said to me bitterly as he passed by with a heavy laundry bag. As I stepped into the gallery on the 12th floor, I saw a group of men standing outside apartment 1204. I recognized C-Note and a few other squatters among them. They were all moving about, trying to keep warm, some of them jumping up and down. The gallery floor was concrete, so even if you were wearing thick-soled shoes, the cold still shot up your legs. The door of 1204 was partially open. Miss Bailey stood over the sofa, and when she caught sight of me, beckoned me inside. I had met Tanisha a few times, most recently at her 21st birthday party, which JT had thrown. She was tall and very pretty, with long, straight black hair, and she was trying to make a career as a model. She currently modeled clothes at various nightclubs, so-called lingerie parties, and also went to college at night. She had a baby boy, Justin, named for her favorite high school teacher, who had encouraged her to pursue modeling. Everyone suspected that JT was the baby's father. He had told me never to ask him about the baby. The light in her apartment was dim, but bright enough to show that her face was beaten badly and her white T-shirt was stained with blood. Her breathing was labored, her eyes closed. You could hear the blood gurgling in her mouth. Another young woman held her hand and comforted her. "They're coming," she said. "The ambulance is coming. Just relax, Nisha." Miss Bailey pulled me aside and asked if I would drive Tanisha to the hospital. "I don't have a car, Miss Bailey," I said. "Didn't you call the ambulance?"
"Okay, then do me a favor," she said. "Ask C-Note to tell the boys in the lobby to take her."
"What about the ambulance?"
"Oh, no, baby," Miss Bailey said softly. "They never come."
I wasn't sure whether to believe her, but at least 15 minutes had passed since I'd arrived and there was no ambulance. Provident Hospital was only 2 miles away. I walked out to the gallery and told C-Note, who simply leaned over and yelled down to the street 12 floors below.
Cheetah! Yo, Cheetah! Miss Bailey says bring the car round. You got to take her to the hospital.
C-Note? Miss Bailey shouted out. Don't yell! He's still in the building! Damn, we can't have him leaving the building!
I was confused. Whom didn't she want to leave the building? Before I could ask, she rounded up the men and addressed them as if she were a general, and they, however,